This was an interesting week. It normally takes me from 1 month to 6 weeks to complete a sermon. I study the Bible text or the topic I want to speak on. I read everything I can find on the subject, take notes, meditate, pray, and then after several days, I write an outline and then a first draft. And I keep that draft on my desk as I work on other sermons, mulling the subject over in my mind and making changes over the weeks. Then during the week before I deliver the sermon, I shape it into its final form. Today's sermon is different. I went through my normal sermon writing process, but I wasn't very happy with the first half of the sermon. It dealt with the church season of Epiphany and a story from the book of Acts about a magician who tries to buy God's power from the apostles Peter and John. And it just didn't really work. And after a few awkward transitions, I managed to get to the second half of the sermon, which was fine. It dealt with a method for solving problems and moral dilemmas that I call jump ahead and look back. The irony in all this is that I actually faced a problem this week and was slow to apply my own problem-solving technique to my problem. So first, I'll explain the jump ahead and look back method, and then I'll tell you about how I applied that method to my own dilemma this week. And I hope I won't regret having cut the gestation period for this sermon to a tiny fraction of the norm. It seems to me there are two sets of problems that keep us from being able to relax and really take joy in being alive. First, there are the little problems that crop up every day. All those problematic details involved in making a living and maintaining a home and keeping peace in a family. Second, there are those big problems, the moral crises in which we're forced to make a decision that just pulls us apart inside. For both of these situations, little nuisance problems and big moral problems, I suggest a technique I call jump ahead and look back. I wish I could claim this as an original idea, but I can't. The concept appears in many forms in various self-help books, including Richard Carlson's Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, although not under that title, Jump Ahead and Look Back. And I certainly do not want to hold myself forth as some sort of wise sage who has found the definitive approach to life. In fact, I will admit that I would be much better off if I would take my own advice as readily as I now pass it on to you. For the little problems, you only have to jump ahead a little ways, a year, to be precise. When wrestling with the often frustrating details of day-to-day life, you simply ask yourself, will this matter a year from now? For this to be effective, you have to sit back, take a few deep breaths, and jump ahead. Take the time to envision yourself sitting wherever it is you're sitting as this problem confronts you, but a full year in the future. Once you have transported yourself and as firmly as possible anchored yourself in the future, look back. Look back at this particular moment and ask yourself how serious this problem really was. It may be an argument with your spouse, a disagreement with your boss, a lost wallet, a collision between your thumb and the business end of a hammer, or any of the other little problems that seem to be a part of everyday human life, problems that throw roadblocks in our paths and challenge us to figure out how to get around them. And I don't want to trivialize these problems because they have a way of making life miserable. I'll give you an example that probably every one of us can identify with, the dreaded flat tire. Is there anything more frustrating than a flat tire? You must either call for a wrecker, pray for the arrival of a saintly stranger, or change the thing yourself. And it is simply no fun changing a flat tire. They are filthy. They are either the spare, is either low on air or it is one of those new spares that's about the size of a drink coaster. You need a degree in mechanical engineering to figure out how the jack is supposed to fit under the frame of your car. And as you bend over beside your car, other vehicles, which are still blessed with fully inflated tires, are whizzing by at about twice the speed limit within 2 or 3 feet of your very exposed derriere. And to make matters worse, you are on your way somewhere. And that's always the case. If we're behind the wheel, it's because we need to get somewhere. And even though we know that everybody has a flat tire now and then, when it happens to us, it is this type of situation which can make us a complete nervous wreck. This is an ideal situation to take a few moments to jump ahead and look back. Picture yourself in that same car, 1 year in the future, driving by the very spot where you now sit with a flat tire. And ask yourself, how big a crisis was that really? Chances are good that while you won't look back fondly on that time as one of the highlights of your life, it will not have been all that big a deal. And as your blood pressure comes back under control, if you jump ahead and look back, you will probably have to admit to yourself that 1 year in the future, you won't even remember where you were going that seemed so important at the time. So much for the little nuisance problems. I said this jump ahead and look back technique also works for big moral problems. The difference is the bigger the problem, the farther ahead you have to jump. If I am confronted with a serious moral dilemma or a situation I simply cannot resolve through my normal decision-making process, I jump ahead to my deathbed. Now, there may be a sort of instinctive revulsion at this idea, but there shouldn't be. I'm not suggesting that we should go through life constantly thinking about the fact God has made us mortal, and that for every person who ever has or ever will live, the time will come when the life they know in this world will be no more. That would be a rather morbid way of going about our daily routines. But those who spend a lot of time around people who are soon to die know that life looks different from that perspective. The dying possess a remarkably keen vision of what it means to be alive, and what it is about being alive that is important, and what things that so often seem important are no more than trivial window dressing. So when you are confronted with one of the big problems, one of the moral dilemmas that keeps you awake for nights on end, one of the situations that overpowers you and just takes over your life, demanding resolution, you may want to try this. Imagine yourself at some point in the distant future, lying on your deathbed, knowing that you are soon to pass beyond the reach of everything you have ever known, with the exception of God's love. And from there, imagine that you think back on the moral dilemma you are facing right now and ask yourself the question, from my deathbed, if I could reach back across time and make that difficult decision I faced at this moment, what would it be? Often, the answer becomes clear in an instant. This jump ahead and look back method won't solve every problem, but it does add a certain perspective that is often missing, a perspective unclouded by the emotions of the moment, a perspective based less on personal pride and self-interest and more on what is right and what is wrong. And now for how I applied this technique to my own life this week. It's a great privilege to stand in the pulpit, but it's also an awesome responsibility. I very much sympathize with Martin Luther, who, when he was first ordained and presided over his first communion, reached a sudden realization of the seriousness of what he was doing in front of all his family and friends who had gathered to witness his first service. He quickly set down the communion bread and ran from the church in terror. I understand how he felt, because I take this role very seriously. There are times people disagree with something I say in the pulpit. I occasionally receive a phone call or a letter as someone wrestles with something I have said. And as anybody who has ever done this knows, they receive unconditional respect from me, both for the views they hold and for the willingness to express their views to me. And I am happy to say that nobody who has ever expressed a disagreement of opinion with me has left the church. In fact, I believe they have come to understand how much I respect them and their ideas, a respect I hold for every member of this congregation. This week, it came to my attention from one of the members of this congregation that there are some who have expressed displeasure with one of my recurring themes from the pulpit, a theme that is prevalent in my pastoral prayers, and that theme is God's love. I became aware of this from a friendly conversation in which the subject was mentioned almost as an aside. I was not told which people feel this way, but as I pursued the matter, I discovered that there are those who think I sort of run the topic of God's love into the ground, overlooking all the horrors this world holds in favor of, well, sort of looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. Now, while I don't feel this is a widely held concern, I want to give you a little background so you will know why I am bringing this up this morning. There are four reasons I decided to address this from the pulpit. First, I spent many years in management for a division of ITT Industries. I was responsible for a small manufacturing facility, a warehouse, an office staff, inside and outside sales personnel, not to mention making sure my little corner of ITT turned a profit. Problems arose frequently, and I learned via the School of Hard Knocks that it is never, ever wise to let a problem go unaddressed. When a problem arises, you set it out for everybody to see, you shine a light on it, and try to resolve it in the best possible way. That's the way I do things. Second, I have learned that personal pride serves no useful purpose when trying to solve a problem. It inevitably gets in the way. And trust me, I know dozens of ministers, and we fall victim to the sin of pride with at least the frequency of the rest of the population. I'll give you an example. Well over a year ago, I heard a criticism of a habit I had developed. I was told there were times in the course of a service when the tone of my voice changed, and there were moments when I did not sound as sincere as at other times. Well, I was really insulted. Until I managed to set aside my foolish pride long enough to listen to the tapes, and much to my dismay, it was a fair criticism. And now, while I will never claim to be a world-class orator, I have attempted to correct what was clearly a problem, and I am grateful that problem was brought to my attention. Third, my experience tells me that for every person who gives voice to a problem or concern, there are several others who are thinking the same thing. So while I understand it is quite a small number who have expressed annoyance at my admittedly repetitive theme of God's love, my assumption is there are more than a few who may feel that way. And last, but by no means least, I bring this up this morning because it became one of those big moral problems for me. After receiving this criticism, I got over my original prideful rage and ran off the last few dozen of my pastoral prayers. And while they are by no means works of genius, they are heartfelt reflections about seeking God's love in a world that often seems pointless, about finding beauty in a world that can be cruel, about finding purpose in lives that so often seem futile. In short, I feel like they address broad matters of concern to people who go to church. So I decided just to put the matter behind me. But I just couldn't get it out of my mind. I couldn't get to sleep. When I finally got it through my thick head that I should listen to my own advice and apply my jump ahead and look back technique to this problem, I was finally able to find some peace. When I jumped ahead and looked back, I realized that this isn't really that big a problem. Or at least, it's not a big problem for me. You see, several things became very clear. First, I love this church. I really do. I love the people. I love the building. I love everything about it. And perhaps most of all, one thing became extremely clear. I love and cherish the freedom of thought we encourage in this place. That may be the most important thing about this place. And it occurred to me that in a place where freedom of thought is treasured as much as it is in this place, people are going to see the world differently. Good people, loving people, devoted to family and church, see this world of ours through very different eyes. And that is a good thing. And then I realized, these are the only eyes I have. And I can't help but tell you how the world looks to me. For me to do anything else would remove any sense of integrity attached to my ministry. I know some people see the world as too frequently cruel, as a cold, brutal, and harsh place with too much suffering to justify belief in a benevolent and loving God. And hear this, it is a testament to the goodness and strength of character of those people that they still respond to the world in a Christian way, with genuine love. And I can't tell you how much I respect that. But let me tell you how the world looks through these eyes. The God I see is not an abstract theological concept. The God I see is the living God. The God I see is not out there somewhere, but is everywhere I look. For it is in God that we live and move and have our being. And the term God's love is actually redundant, because I believe God is love, but love with a capital L, because I believe it is the power that calls creation into being and sustains it moment to moment, a love so perfect that our human concept of love is only a pale imitation. And on my better days, I see that God everywhere I turn. I see God in the immeasurable universe of stars that are painted across that chilling canvas of the immense night sky. I see that God in the way the earth spins, giving us days and nights, and the way it revolves around the sun, tilted on its axis to change the seasons around us. I see that God in the way electrons spin about a nucleus, and the way atoms join to form molecules with such an indescribable innate intelligence. I see God in every leaf of every tree. I see God in people who suffer, and I know God suffers in them. I see God in the goodness of people, like the people of this church, who seek to alleviate suffering in this world, addressing problems with outreach money, volunteering their time and talents to worthwhile causes. I see God in each and every eye in this room. I see God in every tear and in every smile. I hear God in the laughter of children, in the roar of thunder, in the crashing of the waves, in the songs of birds. I feel God with every beat of my heart and with every breath that is drawn into my lungs. That is how the world looks to these eyes. Will God's love remain a recurring theme for my sermons and prayers? For those who wish otherwise, I only hope you understand when I tell you, with all due respect, I have no choice, nor do I want a choice. I can't help but dream of a day when every word I speak and every word you speak become so infused with the love of God that we join voices with all of humanity and say with a new understanding, the kingdom of God is among us. Amen.